From New Mexico to Massachusetts, North Dakota to Florida, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the U.S. and China have signed phase one of a new trade agreement. With details, we are joined today by Dan Griswold from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Articles of impeachment against President Donald Trump have finally been sent to the U.S. Senate, and the trial is about to begin. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Vaping has become an important health topic, and of course, there are new federal regulations. Eric Boehm and Guy Bentley of Reason Magazine are here to discuss the impact. And the Democrat Party's fascination with identity politics could propel Pete Buttigieg to the top tier of finishers in Iowa and New Hampshire. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The trade war between the U.S. and China has ended with the signing of a new agreement. While the agreement does not resolve all of the issues between the two economic giants, it does remove considerable uncertainty from the mix. Here to discuss the deal is Dan Griswold. Dan is Senior Research Fellow and Co-Director of the Trade and Immigration Project at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Dan, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Dan, the United States and China have signed the Phase One trade agreement. This is a major development. For folks who don't know what the background is and what this agreement entails, can you give us an overview?
We've always had a complicated trade relationship with China. I would argue it's been mutually beneficial. American consumers have benefited. China's a major export market for U.S. farmers and producers. But we have some ongoing issues with protection of intellectual property, how they manage and regulate U.S. investment in China. And the Trump administration brought this to a head with what's called a Section 301 report. It's a part of U.S. trade law. They outlined a number of issues we have with China. And then here's the key thing. The Trump administration imposed $50 billion tariffs on $50 billion worth of Chinese imports in the summer of 2018. The Chinese very predictably retaliated, and then the Trump administration escalated to where this fall, last fall, we had tariffs on over $350 billion of imports from China. They had tariffs on most of our exports there. This phase one deal is, first, it's a ceasefire in the escalation of tariffs. The Trump administration agreed not to impose tariffs. They had announced in December. They actually rolled back some tariffs that had been imposed earlier. And the Chinese have agreed to a list of reforms having to do with these issues that the U.S. has raised. The key thing is, up until the signing in the White House, those exact reforms were unknown, only in broad outline. So we're going to see in the days ahead, in the months and years ahead, where this leads us.
In terms of this deal, I know one of the areas that has been a big concern is intellectual property and the fact that the Chinese frequently steal things that have been patented or copyrighted. Does this deal encompass that, or is that set for like a phase? Since this is called phase one, I'm assuming there's going to be a phase two.
They are already talking about phase two, and the president says he's going to go over to China and negotiate that with President Xi. We'll see how that plays out. But you're right. Intellectual property has been a key thing, and we have some issues with China. They violate intellectual property. It's been stolen through cyber attacks, counterfeiting, and other things like that. And so we have a litany of complaints, and that's caused real damage to U.S. exporters, probably measured in the tens of billions of dollars, according to the U.S. International Trade Commission. To put it in some context, though, China's in that way a normal developing country. We have intellectual property issues with Brazil and Turkey and Russia and other countries. And China's also, over time, been improving their intellectual property. They actually pay U.S. companies, I think, close to $10 billion a year to purchase intellectual property, and they're one of the biggest customers, paying customers of U.S. intellectual property. So it's a real issue. I don't think it required these blanket tariffs that have imposed a huge cost on the U.S. economy, consumers, manufacturers, farmers. In the agreement, they have agreed to ramp up their enforcement of intellectual property, and that's a welcome development.
With the signing of this phase one of the trade deal, then, Dan, what do you see as the major benefits to the United States and our economy? And I'm assuming there are also some areas that didn't turn out quite as well as what we had hoped.
Yeah, and again, the details are still coming out as we speak. But I think the biggest benefit of the agreement is that we have stopped or de-escalated this self-damaging tariff war with China. All the studies have shown that the tariffs the Trump administration have imposed, they have imposed a cost on China. They've cost China exports and hurt their economy, but they've hurt us as well. Prices have gone up for American consumers. Supply chains have been disrupted. U.S. manufacturing is kind of in a not an outright recession now, but a lot of worrying signs. And also, of course, our farmers, our great farmers, have lost billions of dollars of exports to China, soybeans, pork. So, and then over that, it's the uncertainty. Markets hate uncertainty. That's imposed a cost. So just to bring that escalating trade war to a stop has been good for the U.S. economy, and we've seen the stock market react in a positive way. And then to the extent that China agrees to respect intellectual property, reform its economy in a market direction, that's all positive. I guess the big question hanging over this is one, we're paying a real cost every day with the tariffs, and what we've got in return are promises for future conduct from China. I would argue there is a better way to approach this rather than these blanket tariffs. Let's take China to the World Trade Organization and challenge them there. Let's have sanctions on specific bad actors. We've got tools in the law that are more precise rather than this indiscriminate tariff war that we've been in.
Another concern on the horizon, somewhat separate from the trade deal, but of course all these things are to a degree interrelated. The Chinese economy has been slowing down, Dan. Is this going to be a factor in the phase two negotiations going forward? And just generally, what impact does it have on the U.S. economy when the Chinese economy slows down?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yes. One, it puts some pressure on the Chinese leadership to respond. They're a dictatorship, but part of their legitimacy in their own eyes is that they've delivered prosperity to the Chinese people. I'd argue that it's the Chinese people operating in at least a freer market that have delivered that prosperity. But one, it has some political ramifications within China. But you're right. It affects us here in the United States. To the extent that the Chinese economy is growing, they're more able to buy U.S. products. China has been one of the biggest growth markets for U.S. They're a great market, at least up until this trade war, for U.S. farm products.
We have been talking with Dan Griswold, who is the Senior Research Fellow and Co-Director of the Trade and Immigration Project at the Mercatus Center, which of course is located at George Mason University. Dan, tell us a little bit about the Mercatus Center and also where folks can go to learn more.
The Mercatus Center is a nonprofit educational institution. We've been around for 40 years. We produce studies and other research on issues of public policy, showing how markets can solve societal problems. People can see all our work at our website, which is mercatus.org, www.mercatus.org.
Dan Griswold of the Mercatus Center. Dan, thank you for being here.
It's been a pleasure, Loman.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, and there's only really one topic to talk about in D.C. this week, that is impeachment. We're going to do just that. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman. It's always great to be with you on these fun occasions here in Washington.
Yeah, Washington, again, not really getting anything of substance done, at least Congress isn't. The president did get the trade deal that we just talked about, but Congress is going to be completely focused, the Senate, on impeachment. What should we expect to see happen in the coming days, Scott?
This week, Nancy Pelosi named the House impeachment managers that will be over in the United States Senate, making the case to the United States senators that the president should be convicted of, well, what should he be convicted of? Well, actually, they didn't even accuse him of committing any crimes, but they want to convict him of these two articles, obstruction of Congress and the bottom line here is that we're going to be in a situation where it's such a slim majority for the Republicans, 53-47 if you include the two independents that caucus with the Democrats. And that means that if three Republicans splinter off, they can join the Democrats in calling new witnesses and hearing new information related to the impeachment inquiry. What you've seen over the last few days is really sort of a game of poker. And you've got senators like Ted Cruz from Texas and Rand Paul from Kentucky, and they're warning these moderate Republicans that if they join with the Democrats in calling new witnesses, that Republicans should be able to call witnesses that we want to hear from. And number one, that includes the whistleblower, the so-called whistleblower that didn't actually have any evidence. It was all secondhand knowledge that he received. So there's no proof. And that also includes Adam Schiff, right? Adam Schiff was in the middle of depositions prior to the impeachment inquiry even being announced. So I think Republicans will want to call Adam Schiff. And then we have this candidate for president, Joe Biden, and his son, Hunter Biden. I think that there's a lot of Republicans that would be interested in forcing that vote. So that's what happens if you see Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski and Mitt Romney and maybe some others joining with the Democrats to call new witnesses. You can be certain that there will be votes to also entertain this idea that those Republican witnesses should be called to testify before the United States Senate.
One senator who on the Democrat side is perhaps expected or most likely to side with Republicans is the U.S. Senator from West Virginia, Joe Manson. You've done a poll there. How do things look for this senator in West Virginia? And does that buttress the thought that he may, in fact, side with Republicans on this issue?
I think on the front end, Senator Manchin is probably going to be voting with the Democrats, any party line type votes, right? But this is about closing the impeachment inquiry and ending impeachment in the Senate. How does Joe Manchin vote at the end? That's a big question. He might join with the Republicans. And, you know, I'd be shocked if any others were really on the table as gettable votes. But what Club for Growth PAC did was check with West Virginia voters to see what kind of political blowback Joe Manchin would face if he voted to convict President Trump on either of the articles of impeachment passed by the Democrats-controlled Senate. Basically, this poll showed generally that there was overwhelming opposition in West Virginia to remove President Trump from office. And nearly 7 in 10, 69% of West Virginia voters said that they opposed doing that, while only 27% voiced support of removing the president from office. And in addition to that, you have 67% of West Virginia voters that approve of the job that President Trump is currently doing, while only 31% don't approve. So this poll found that there was a plurality of voters that would view Manchin much more favorably if he changed his party affiliation to the Republican Party. Now, will that actually ever happen? Republicans, in many fashions, have been courting Senator Manchin for a long time, and he still hasn't changed parties, but obviously we had a flip with Jeff Van Drew in New Jersey in the House of Representatives, changing from Democrat to Republican over the impeachment inquiry. And so this is real important data that Senator Manchin is reading about now that we've published the report and had an article written by Alexander Bolton in The Hill, which is a Washington publication that a lot of members and their staff in Congress read every single day. So we're pretty excited about the results of these things, right? Even if Manchin decides to side with the Democrats, it shows that he's got real vulnerabilities by really bucking the opinion and the positions of West Virginia voters.
Another state, and I know you haven't done a poll there, at least not yet, is Alabama, which is probably the state most likely to flip from Democrat to Republican this year. The president, Scott, very, very popular in Alabama. Isn't that going to make an impeachment vote by the Democratic senator from Alabama very difficult?
I think that this is the best pickup opportunity in the entire country for Republicans on the Senate map. And Doug Jones and the way that Alabamians think about this issue, it's real thorny for him. Now, I think he's less gettable than Joe Manchin, right? He is up for re-election, and if he change parties, he's facing all these Republicans. right? So that's unlikely. If he doesn't change parties and voted against the impeachment articles, then he would still find himself in a situation where he's bucking all those Democrats. So we'll see exactly what the Alabama voters think. That's a race that's coming up for the primary on March 3rd, and then there will be a runoff election, and then obviously we'll be facing Doug Jones in November of 2020.
Another group of individuals who are going to be affected by the timing of this impeachment trial are the remaining U.S. senators still in the presidential race, or in the race for the Democratic presidential nomination. Iowa primary is now just a couple of weeks away. Does this advantage Joe Biden because he won't be stuck in Washington over the next couple of weeks?
Well, it depends if he's called as a witness. He might be coming.
Yeah,
you're right. We obviously have Elizabeth Warren, Amy Klobuchar, and Bernie Sanders that are currently in the presidential race. They were all participating in the debate that happened this week. And so that would take them off the campaign field, take them out of Iowa, take them out of New Hampshire, and really limit their ability to connect on a personal level with a lot of those voters. Now, they'll obviously still be up on TV. They'll still be able to go there on Sundays. But Mitch McConnell's intention here is to hold the Senate in 6 days a week until the impeachment debate is completed in the Senate.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson. Scott, of course, with the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a little bit about the Club.
Sure. So the Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of our nation's capital. If your listeners are interested in checking us out on our website, the website is clubforgrowth.org, and our Twitter handle is @clubforgrowth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, we'll continue following all of this drama with you again next week. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Vaping was supposed to be a healthier alternative to smoking tobacco products, but the practice has contributed to health-related problems of its own. That means more involvement by the federal government, as we find out from Eric Boehm and Guy Bentley of Reason Magazine.
The Trump administration has generally been pretty good about not imposing new regulations, but one area where they have been more active is with tobacco and vaping products, and that's something that we're going to take a look at today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Guy Bentley. He is the Director of Consumer Freedom for the Reason Foundation. He's a colleague of mine, a friend of the show. He's been here before. We're glad to have him back. He follows everything that goes on in sort of the world of vice, if you will, drinking, smoking, all those fun things that maybe you shouldn't do too much of. Guy, thanks for taking some time and joining us here again today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, there's been a lot going on in your world. Let's start. I really want to talk about vaping, but let's start quickly with something that people have probably heard about, and that is this big tobacco issue where now you have to be 21 to buy tobacco in this country. This is a sort of a new policy just passed in the last few months. Tell us, like why did this happen? Why did we up the age? This is about, what, keeping kids from smoking?
That's right, Eric. The tobacco age of 21 includes all products that are classified as tobacco products. So that includes your e-cigarettes, smokeless tobacco, regular cigarettes, cigars, everything. So that is now equivalent to the age of purchase for alcohol. We didn't think this policy was a particularly good idea. We think it's an unnecessary and unfair solution to problems such as cracking down numbers of kids vaping, for instance. Also, nobody talks about the record low numbers of youth who are using cigarettes. But this was a policy that was supported by almost all of the tobacco industry, almost all of the vapor industry. It was supported by Republicans and Democrats on the Hill and the Republicans as well. So it was something of a foregone conclusion. It is unfortunate. I think it's unfair that many adults in this country can go and serve their country in the military but cannot buy, say, a vapor product at their local 7-Eleven. So,
yeah, exactly. That's exactly the point. And that's what always kind of makes me scratch my head. You can serve in the military at 18. You can vote for the president of the United States or for the mayor of your town. You're a fully functioning adult. And yet we don't trust you to make the decision about whether you can drink or smoke or not. I don't know. Let's talk about vaping, though, Guy, because I think this is in some ways really more interesting. And there's a lot more sort of dynamics to this story. The flavored vaping in particular has come under attack in the past year that tobacco companies or vaping companies are supposedly marketing these flavored e-cigarettes to teenagers and to kids. And there's been a significant spike in youth vaping. And so now what the FDA and the Trump administration have effectively banned like a huge set of e-cigarettes. Give us the details here of what's legal and what's illegal now.
Yeah, that's right. You'll remember last year, Eric, that two of the major stories involving vaping that did somewhat take the country by storm was this outbreak of lung illnesses and deaths that was allegedly associated with vaping, and also a separate issue that new data showed another increase in the number of high schoolers and middle schoolers who had been experimenting and trying e-cigarette products. We also did actually get a great bit of news that year, which is that the smoking rate amongst youth fell by the largest single amount ever recorded in one year, which was great news. The youth smoking rate is at a historic low in this country. So that was good, but very much swamped out by the increase in the numbers of youth experimenting with e-cigarettes. In September, President Trump announced from the Oval that it was his administration's intention to ban the sale of all non-tobacco flavored e-cigarettes. So that includes all flavors sold at vape shops, or every kind of menthol, mint, fruit candy, anything you can get. Now, what's happened recently instead is that the administration has shifted their stance from banning all non-tobacco flavors to instead banning all non-tobacco and non-menthol flavors in what we call closed system e-cigarettes. So that's your Juuls, that's your Vuse, your Blues. These are usually the kind of e-cigarettes that you'll get in something like a 7-Eleven or a convenience store. But the administration did exempt and said flavors can stay on the market for vape shops and so-called open system products. And these are usually products sold in specialist vape shops and so on. So it wasn't exactly the victory that we wanted, but it was at least a stemming of what would have been a really disastrous full-scale prohibition.
Yeah, partial prohibition, I guess partial prohibition is better than full prohibition. I'd rather not have any prohibition at all, but a little bit better than none at all. Just about a minute left here, Guy. Now, I want to go back to one thing you said earlier. Teen smoking is really on the decline. In fact, smoking rates in general are on the decline, and some people attribute that to vaping, that people are making the switch from smoking cigarettes to vaping. That is a healthier choice. It's not necessarily the healthiest thing you could do, but that is a sort of a public health win, right? If people switch from cigarettes to e-cigarettes.
That's a really great point to make. The key thing to think about with legal nicotine e-cigarettes is that they're around 95 to 99% safer than traditional cigarettes. Ideally, the best thing you can do for your health is not use any of these products at all. But if smoking is too hard to quit and the traditional methods haven't worked for you, switching to vaping is a great option. And now we have good data showing that at least, at a minimum, 3 million or more Americans have switched over from smoking to vaping. Many of those will live many more years, will have far lower instances of lung cancers and deaths, and that's great news. And that is continuing. More than, I think it's between 10 and 15 million adult Americans currently vape. That's great news. We can and should get youth vaping down, but you cannot ignore the massive benefits of harm reduction that e-cigarettes provide.
Yeah, it's really one of those seen and unseen kind of issues, right? We see the stories about the handfuls of people who have died from using these black market illicit vaping devices. What you don't see, though, are all the people who have switched from cigarettes to vaping, not using black market devices, using legitimate vaping devices. And those people, over the size of the U.S. population, that means more people are going to live longer, healthier lives in the long run. That's not something that makes front page news, of course, but that is kind of the reality of the smoking vaping situation. We are unfortunately out of time for today. Guy Bentley from the Reason Foundation, thanks for taking some time and being here with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And again, that is Guy Bentley. He is the Director for Consumer Freedom at the Reason Foundation. You can go to reason.org to find everything that he has been working on. For Reason Magazine, that's reason.com. Find me and all my work over there. I am Eric Boehm, and I will catch you right back here next week again on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The Democrat Party places a high priority on identity politics, and this year's beneficiary of that trait is Pete Buttigieg. So says Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College on this American Radio Journal commentary.
A friend informs me of a young lady from his hometown and home church. Valedictorian of her classical Christian high school, she was a solid evangelical raised in an evangelical home, an evangelical church, and by evangelical parents. Guess what she did for break? My friend asked me. She headed to Iowa to volunteer for Pete Buttigieg's presidential campaign. My friend was perplexed that a conservative evangelical girl would spend college break knocking on doors for a cultural radical to be president of the United States. Actually, it's no mystery. The answer is right there. She's in college. This promising young lady went to an elite university in the Northeast. End of story. In no time, she was fundamentally transformed, fully converted from Bible-believing evangelical to LGBTQ crusading leftist. It took only two or three semesters. That's no surprise. That's the job of these colleges, after all. That's what they do. From the very first day, orientation day, when your son or daughter is asked which gender pronoun he or she prefers, young Americans are overwhelmed with obsessive, unrestrained, unhinged identity ideology. They are force-fed a nonstop toxic diet of race, gender, and sexual identity. Thus, in 2008, college students wanted Barack Obama to be president because, first and foremost, he's African-American. In 2016, college students wanted Hillary Clinton to be president because, first and foremost, she's a woman. In 2020, college students want Pete Buttigieg to be president because, first and foremost, he's homosexual. Race, gender, sexual orientation. They're Trinity, they're Alpha and Omega. They are on the Pete Buttigieg bandwagon. They are on a rainbow crusade. They are Pete Buttigieg's rainbow crusaders. They are Mayor Pete's rainbow army. This is a major reason for Mayor Pete's surge in the polls. The Real Clear Politics average has him first in New Hampshire and first in Iowa. He has pulled ahead of the Democrat pack comfortably, ahead of Biden and Warren and Sanders, thanks in part to the zeal of his crusaders marching into Iowa as if searching for the Holy Grail in some barn outside of Des Moines. The Real Clear Politics average actually has Mayor Pete leading Donald Trump by 47% to 44%. If you find it astounding that the zeitgeist in America could have changed this quickly, so much so that a homosexual man legally married to another man could receive the Democratic Party nomination in 2020, the party of Jack Kennedy and Harry Truman and the Teamsters and the steelworkers and Jimmy Hoffa and William Jennings Bryan and Scoop Jackson, well, then you're missing a vitally important fact. It's precisely because Pete Buttigieg is a homosexual man legally married to another man that he could receive the Democratic Party nomination in 2020. To endless millions of millennials educated in our universities, this is the principal reason why Mayor Pete should be president. This also means that there will likely be still a further uptick in Mayor Pete's support as more college kids during breaks hop planes to Iowa and New Hampshire to show up at rallies. Many will travel on the dime of their conservative evangelical parents, the same parents subsidizing the indoctrination they're receiving at left-wing colleges. The parents, you see, pay the progressive pipers at the classroom podiums. Mom and Pop are the unwitting financiers of Mayor Pete's Rainbow Army. How many divisions does the Pope have? Snickered Joseph Stalin. Well, Pope John Paul II swept into Poland in June 1979, and the Kremlin got an unexpected answer, an army of supporters. How many divisions does Mayor Pete have? The answer, millions in our liberal universities. Don't be shocked by his army of supporters. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WLMR-AM in Chattanooga, Tennessee, WSKY-AM in Asheville, North Carolina, along with WFAM-AM in Augusta, Georgia. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.